Hi, my name is Xiaodong Zhang from University of North Dakota. I have a question for the first speaker. If, in the perfect world, all the crop can reach their potential, will there be enough food for the world population in the future? Thank you.
And the good news is yes, but most of that untapped potential will be in areas with very low yields today. So the fact that countries in Asia or the Middle East that are investing in farmland in Africa or South America, it's probably a very shrewd move.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Tremblay from Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada. My question is to Bill Rahm. Bill, you said that what's important, well, at least one thing that is important, is to separate the estimation of yield potential from the one of response to nitrogen. Do you have a clue how we can get further in actually getting a better assessment of response to nitrogen by itself? How?
Okay, they have to be separated because if they're embedded, like in a sufficiency concept that's independent of yield level, you will not get the right nitrogen rate. You've got to assess yield potential apart from N responsiveness. That yield level is going to dictate, or it's not going to dictate, it's part of the equation. That yield level is going to have its influence and control on N demand. Sensing for nitrogen only, to date, and that's why a lot of us still use that technology, that SPAD meter is, if that's what I'm after, the SPAD meter is going to be what we would use. NDVI and some of the red edge indexes simply won't work.
I have a question for Dr. Rahm. Right now, the sensors that we have available in the market primarily identifies the stresses associated with nitrogen, or that's what we assume the stress is related to.
Yeah.
When do you think we might see generation 2 of the sensors, which will help us identify the real stress, not an assumption that's related to nitrogen?
The sensors that are out there really don't detect nitrogen stress. I mean, they really don't. I mean, the sensors that are out there detect levels of biomass, I mean, accurately. Yes, to a certain degree, some in stress, but they're basically biomass sensors. The amount of biomass that's out there. The amount of biomass produced per day is growth rate. The growth rate is tied to yield potential, so that's really what we're doing. Validating that it's actual N, or when can we determine that it's an N stress? Again, V10, V12 is when you want to get that nitrogen on. When you're putting in corn, when you're putting down the nitrogen after V12, you can increase protein, but you probably can't catch up to increase yields. There's some other data out there that would say otherwise, but I think for the most part, you want to make that end decision before V12, and I think the sensors that are out there are more than capable of detecting those end differences, provided that we've got that rich strip at that growth stage. And I think that they all work incredibly well. In wheat, we have a larger window. We can go in at Fekes 5, and determine that very, very accurately, and probably have a 40-day window where we don't have that in corn. But these systems that are out there work, and I think are working well, but we have to refine them, and we have to include some of the inputs that were addressed in the first presentation by Dr. Kassman today.
Other questions?
Yes.
Hi, Peter John from New Zealand. This isn't my area, so it may be a dumb question, but for Bill, I know that one of our research centers has seen a high variability in root volume, irrespective with exactly the same soil, same nitrate level, and so on. So when you look at the variability between plants, Could a proportion of that be due to that rather than receiving a variable nitrogen rate?
Well, that's an excellent point. I mean, again, and that comes back to that issue of yield potential. I don't really care what it's due to. I don't care if it's root pruning, root growth, differences that were there, or delayed emergence because those roots didn't develop as quickly. It doesn't matter to us. We're going to look at each of those individual plants and determine the yield potential that that has. And if that plant, for example, is a little bit delayed, especially in corn, it gets 6-7 days behind the other plant in terms of emergence, it's a weed. And it's competing for nutrients and moisture versus that next plant. And we're going to make a decision, again, on a by-plant basis because that could well be the issue. But, again, tied to yield potential.
Other questions? Yes.
Yes, my name is Jean-Pierre Goffard from Belgium, from Jean Blou. So you speak us about the interest of nitrogen-rich reference plot. In Belgium, we also use reference plot in our decision support system, but we also have arguments for the use of zero reference plot. So what's your opinion, except the fact that farmers don't like to avoid putting nitrogen, of course?
Any type of reference, whether it's zero or high end, you know, anything that you can incorporate into that decision-making process for that farmer is going to be a plus. So would that zero-end plot be worthwhile? Absolutely. But getting them for us, just getting them to put out an enriched strip has been a major hurdle. That then those guys that adopt some of that technology, he or she is going to try zero-end plots in addition to the enriched strip plots because they're curious and because they have that curious mind. But again, just getting them going, sometimes we have to put out the enriched strip for them, which we've done. One of our guys, Danny Pieper, he got chased out of a field with a shotgun, and he was out there with a fertilizer applicator putting out enriched strips for one of his clients. No, the farm didn't want it. Well, 3 years later, he was on the phone and says, Danny, can you get my enriched strips out this year? So,
I'd like to add something to that about the N0 plots, the omission plots. There's another reason to put them on, not so much for predicting the need for nitrogen in that season, but for benchmarking the performance of the field. Because if you tell me the yield you get in a non-nitrogen fertilized plot and the yield that you get in with the farmer's management, I can recreate the whole nitrogen balance of the field and predict within reasonable limits what the nitrogen fertilizer uptake efficiency is. And in a world where we're going to have to be convincing the general public as well as grocery stores and marketers that buy our product that we're using methods that are achieving improvements in nitrogen use efficiency, I think the nitrogen zero benchmark is perhaps very important because with that you can actually document and validate your actual nitrogen fertilizer uptake efficiency.
I see another question over there.
Yes, I have one. Duane Westfall, Colorado State University. I have one for Ken. You painted a pretty dismal picture for us, you know, here on, I'm just glad I'm the age I am. I'm not going to starve to death, but maybe some of you younger people will. But anyway, Ken, the science community has done an excellent job of getting funding for genetic engineering, what I'll call it. But there is no funding out there or very little funding for us on the ground that do fertility work, nitrogen use efficiency work, and et cetera. Funding now is climate change, carbon sequestration, gene jockey work. How are we going to address the issues that you have presented as far as the agronomics without someone getting on the bandwagon and saying, we need to start directing some of our funding towards this area and supporting this area of research?
Boy, that's a great question. And I think it was 1988 or so, I invited Dwayne to UC Davis to give a talk. Do you remember, Dwayne? And I was in charge of a course in the International Agricultural Development Program, master's program. And we were hoping to stimulate at that time greater interest in the kind of agroecology research that Dwayne was doing on improving productivity of very harsh dryland systems. It looked very promising and was a success story. And the idea was to inculcate that idea with a lot of young people in this international ag development program, who were very idealistic, mostly thinking about organic agriculture and these things, which also is getting funding, by the way, these days, expanded funding. We're in an interesting situation, aren't we? That if I'm right, I don't see how those numbers could be wrong, unless FAO has bad numbers on yields, and some people argue that. But it does seem to me that we're like an alcoholic at the early stages of treatment. You know what they say about alcoholism is that there's no way to solve your problem until you admit you have a problem. And so in a world where no policymaker I know of, no leader of a major U.S. land-grant university or agricultural experiment station or the USDA or FAO or World Bank is stating that we're on a crash course, very important words, we are on a crash course of not being able to meet food demand on existing farmland unless we massively expand farm area, I don't see a lot of hope. But having said that, because if you don't know what the problem is, of course you're going to waste money. You're going to invest in things, and anyone that walks through the door sounds good. And it's cheaper than if I invest in this guy with 2,000 strips in actual farmers' fields. That's going to be very costly. So I think it's time for agronomists, soil scientists to start calling attention to this, to challenge those. It's not that we're against the major seed companies, Bill. I wanted to clarify that. I sure as hell hope Monsanto stays in business. Its stock price looks pretty tenuous right now. But and we need the DuPonts and the Pioneers, and we need the Syngentas. We need major seed companies. They've been an important component of productivity gains in the last 30 to 40 years, and they will in the future. But what we don't need is hype that takes the eye off of the cue ball, as we say, playing pool, in helping us prioritize what needs to be done and investing whatever money we have for it wisely. So we're in a race against time. It's like building a baseball team. How many of you know American baseball or cricket? Yeah, cricket or baseball? And if you're going to build a team, you have to select people to be on your team that have a good batting average. That is, you look at their record over their career and how many times have they hit the ball and got successfully on first base and driven in runs. So if you're going to build a team in a global research community to address this incredible challenge of food security, more attention has to be made to get policymakers and those in key positions, people that have actually made a difference in agriculture, people that have a batting average that's respectable. And at the bottom line, that's the biggest problem we have. We're filled in our universities and our policymaking institutions with people that have never had any experience in what it takes to make a difference in agriculture.
I have a question right here.
I'm V.C. Patil from Christian Agriculture Research Chair, King Saud University, Saudi Arabia. I have a question to both of them. We have been working, look at the Christian Agriculture Research in the last two decades. Everything is centered around one single nutrient element, nitrogen. How far are we going in the right direction? Are we forgetting the basic soil science, basic agronomy of other nutrients? We consider only nitrogen as a yield determining factor, which probably may not be very right. I don't know, with this kind of direction, in precision agriculture research focusing on one nutrient element, how far are we right?
Well, I'll just go first. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why nitrogen is probably the most important of the inputs, but it doesn't mean that there shouldn't be a lot of work on other limiting factors. And in fact, when I had a call at the end of my talk for documentable cases where it's made a difference, I'd like to see it with zone management of lime or phosphorus or varying hybrid or crop cultivars with landscape position based upon yield potential. Any of those will satisfy my call for documentable cases that have shows that precision agriculture can increase yields, increase profit, protect soil quality, environmental quality, and so forth.
Soil testing remains a viable, profitable system that's out there that has to be used. So with nutrient management on nitrogen that we push, we encourage every single farmer to soil test, and that's actually done first. Now, as a follow-up to that, the nitrogen is his largest input, and if we can make a difference and a change in terms of what he's doing with nitrogen, we can put a lot of money in his pocket just by nitrogen. Now, I would follow that up to say that now for almost 8 years, we have some really nice data on foliar P that looks good, that much more efficient, can apply a lot lower rates than you can with soil applied, different products with foliar P, and then the same thing goes with potassium. So are we ignoring these other nutrients? Absolutely not. But what you see at the forefront is nitrogen, because that's where we can put a big bang in his pocket. And again, over the last few years, if the farmer will put out enriched strips, follow our recommendations in winter, we can average him $25 an acre in his pocket. And money's the one that sells.
Okay, we have a few minutes left. I will entertain one more question from the audience. And while you're thinking on that, I have a question for Dr. Kassman. From your presentation, I gather genetics, in your opinion, may or may not be the best solution going forward. It's a part of the solution. Is there any advice you have for, as Duane defines it, gene jockeys? You talk about genetic potential. Is there a way we can alter the genetic potential? What would be top three advice or top three things would you like to address to the geneticist who are indeed working on this issue?
Well, the first would be that there's a growing body of literature that gives a strong theoretical background about what traits are likely to be amenable with genetics and what aren't. And there are a lot of good ones that are, but you need to have a conceptual theoretical framework of how to identify those. They're not nitrogen efficiency and they're not drought, but there are many others. And so the first would be to read that literature and either refute it or understand it. It has to do with use of evolutionary theory in deciding what genes are most likely to be controllable by one or two simple genes, such that that's all we can do with biotechnology is modify. We can either upregulate, downregulate, or knock out or add one or two genes. And so you have to think about what traits are most likely to be amenable by upregulating, downregulating one or two genes. And so that's number one. Number two is that a lot more of genetic screening early on has to be done in high-yield environments. That there's this idea that you must screen under stress and low yield if you're trying to improve stress and low yield. And I think the data are quite clear. My colleague Jim Speck at the University of Nebraska is eloquent on this, but many others. It turns out that the most efficient way to improve genetic resistance to stress and yields in harsh environments is to breed under very competitive, high plant density environments at high yield, and then test your best lines also under stress, rather than doing your early selection under stress and then hoping that they're also going to be good in good years.
So it's turning the whole thing around. And I really don't have a third, but those would be two things that if it just goes against the current dogma in the crop improvement world.